our corridors keep changing. Did you know that there would have been no Serum Run without something called Womcats? Or that after the Alaska Purchase, the Navy was put in charge of Alaska and the Army had to conceal the fact that it was exploring the interior? Good morning. I'm Steve Heimel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Alaska's corridors, forgotten, remembered, past, and future, the topic today. What forgotten corridor do you know about? 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage of 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. We're looking at how we move information and value from here to there on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Alaska Pacific University is a private liberal arts and sciences university that emphasizes student engagement with the social, cultural, and environmental issues in Alaska and the world. This message sponsored by APU. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
It's going to be one of those calls that I have such an incredible panel that the listeners may feel intimidated and not want to call, but I think participation by the listeners would be eagerly looked forward to by all three of the panelists on the show, and me too, because the fact of the matter is, when you talk about history, folk history, and our corridors and how we use them, how we did use them, how we will use them, well, you're really the experts. We're just here trying to figure it all out. So I think I'll introduce them one by one, just very briefly, and then kind of go to a discussion with each of them and remind you of the phone number, 1-800-478-8255 statewide. In Anchorage, it's local at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. That'll probably come in handy a little later on. So first, joining us by telephone, it's my honor to present Walt Bornman, author of Alaska, Saga of a Bold Land, a really nice and smooth reading history of the state of Alaska. And that's his specialty. He writes those very readable histories, especially about the West. And he joins us by telephone from Colorado. Walt, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you doing today?
Thanks, Steve. Good morning. Good to be with you up there.
Yeah, it's great. When did you write that book?
I wrote that book. It was published in 2003. It's still in print, both with e-books and paperback.
Yeah, and it's the one with the Sidney Lawrence painting on the front cover of it.
Of Denali, correct.
Yeah, Saga of a Bold Land. Also with me is the executive director of the Great Land Trust, Phil Shepard. Phil, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks very much, Steve.
How long have you been running the Great Land Trust, and tell me what it does?
I've been running it for 7 years. It's been around 20 years this year. It does land conservation in South Central Alaska.
So it's land use is past, present, future, and very much dealing with trails, right?
Exactly. We've got a number of trails on a number of our properties. One of our programs is called Access to the Chugach, Pathways to the Chugach. We purchase properties specifically to provide access to public lands that we are blessed to have here in Alaska.
My third guest. Yes, a third guest. Morgan Blanchard is a senior project archaeologist at the Northern Land Use Research Alaska, which essentially is the outfit that does a lot of the archaeological work. Whenever they're going to have a construction project, they got to have an archaeologist, and he's the man. Morgan, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Oh, thank you very much.
And we've got three basic walking encyclopedias here with us on the show, a highly qualified panel. So what are we going to talk about? Well, corridors is it. And I'm going to start with you, Morgan, because you are you're the Womcats guy. And I brought up right at the very beginning that there wouldn't have been a Serum Run if there hadn't been a Womcats. And, of course, 99% of the people listening right now, but a very important 1% does know what it is. But the rest of them don't, so we need a little background on what this project was, a
sure.
Military communications tree, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the Womcats was the Washington-Alaska Military Cable and Telegraph System, and it was a system that was developed by Congress. Essentially, they funded it to bring communications to Alaska after the Gold Rush. When the discovery of gold in the Yukon massive numbers of people moved into the Alaskan interior, and this was quite a challenge. So the Army was sent in to establish forts in a number of different places and establish some sort of control. Fort Egbert's probably the most important one for that, being so close to Dawson. But the big problem was you couldn't speak to the forts and you couldn't speak to the people. And so Congress funded this project as a joint military and civilian project to actually bring an electronics communication system into the interior of Alaska so they could control what was going on at the forts and bring supplies and communication into the Alaskan interior.
And, you know, and it's actually still during the gold rush that they actually get a cable put across Norton Sound.
Yeah, well, that's actually a fascinating story, but let me back up a little bit. Essentially, between 1900 and 1904, they built about 1,500 miles of telegraph throughout the interior of Alaska and over 2,000 miles of undersea cable that connected Valdez to Seattle. So the system ran from Valdez to Eagle in a big run and then stretched out through the interior to Fairbanks, then all the way out to Nome. So massive number of miles that were involved in this, and they had to put telegraph stations about every 40 miles along the route. And so there were these poor guys who were stationed out there two at a time in these stations, sending messages along and maintaining the lines. It was quite a thing.
You know, now that you bring it up, and this just popped into my head, and I can't remember who was flying me where, but he looked down and he saw these leaning cattywampus telephone poles in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, that's Wamcats.
Yeah, you can see it. If you're flying in the bush in a number of areas, you can still see the cleared areas. Some places I've actually seen tripods still standing, lying on poles. And so it's quite amazing. And you brought up a fascinating thing about trying to lay cable under the Norton Sound. The other element of Wamcats was it was a pioneer in radio. The first radio systems ever to go into operation anywhere in the world as part of a normal everyday communication system were between St. Michael and Port Safety across the Norton Sound. And they started construction in 1902 and were in operation in 1903. So remarkable. It was a technological marvel of its age. They'd actually, companies like Queen and Company and Marconi had attempted to build similar systems for a year or two prior to hand and couldn't do it. And it was the Army that actually developed the technology and installed it. It's a remarkable story.
Whoa, thank you so much. We're talking about Morgan Blanchard, who wrote his PhD dissertation on the subject of Wamcats, as it turns out. It's great to have you with us. And I want to turn now to Walt Borman, historian, author of Alaska, Saga of a Bold Land. And this is a story you didn't know too much about, right, Walt?
Well, I said to you that I wasn't an expert on the Wamcats, but the interesting thing is that the Wamcats and the telegraph that Morgan is talking about is really comes after the very first attempt in 1865 to put a telegraph line through Alaska, because at that point they think that that's a great route across the Bering Sea to connect North America all the way across Siberia and Russia to Europe.
All the dreams they had.
Those were the first dreams, indeed.
Yeah. So this is this a William Henry Seward dream then?
Well, this is just a couple years before William Henry Seward acquires Alaska in 1867.
With still Russian?
William Dahl and the Alaska Telegraph Survey. And, you know, you've mentioned and alluded to how things and technologies change, and corridors across Alaska might change with those changing technologies. But what basically happens, and what's the death knell of the Telegraph Survey of 1865, which essentially means we have to wait until what Morgan's talking about with Wamcats to bring that telegraph system through, is that there is a transatlantic under ocean cable finally completed by Cyrus Field between the east coast of the United States and Great Britain. And with that route and that communication back and forth, they basically abandoned their goal of trying to get a telegraph line across Alaska as early as 1865.
Wow. Before the purchase.
Yes, 2 years before the purchase.
Amazing. Yeah, Walt Borman is with us. He's author of Alaska, Saga of a Bold Land. And I think before we go on to the issue of Henry Miles and Lieutenant Schwatka, which ties in with the gold rush, I think we'll turn to Phil Shepard at this point of the Great Land Trust, because Phil... You know, I noticed that we're not going to have the Iditarod race here this year. It's going to start in Fairbanks. They're going to put some snow around as best they can and do a ceremonial start here, and then everybody will go up to Fairbanks and start the race on a different route. It'll still follow part of the Iditarod, but the part that goes through to Mat-Su, not so much. Rainy Pass, not so much. I guess some people are going to try it with bicycles and so forth.
Right.
But you have, with the trust, have been working on the easements and so forth for all this these trail systems, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, because I became aware a few years ago of all the work that BLM have been doing on this trail, this corridor. And here is, its nature is going through another change right now, but it has been actually, when you look back, for a while. There's other users than dog mushers. And I distinctly remember when we did a radio feature that involved the diary of someone who worked with Joe Reddington to start tracing right at the very beginning. You know, he was fascinated with that trail. It wasn't just dog mushing. Dog mushing was a way to reestablish the trail, but he was obsessed with the trail and finding where it had been. Mm-hmm. And so he got these army people talked into doing it as a military exercise. Wow. It's pretty good.
Well, so Great Land Trust does land conservation projects across South Central Alaska. One of the features, as I mentioned, is connecting Anchorage citizens with our public lands and corridors. And so many of the trails, many of the projects that we work on involve corridors and trying to figure out what do we want Alaska, what do we want South Central Alaska to be like in 20 and 50 years? How do we maintain these corridors that are really important for wildlife, transportation, and things like historic corridors, things like the historic Iditarod Trail? And many of the projects we've been doing lately involve parcels of land at the mouths of streams, which are really important historically. Lots of, you know, settlements have been there. Lots of, fish camps have been there for thousands of years. And it just so happens when we do these land conservation projects, we do oftentimes conserve historic sections of the Iditarod Trail. And we've now conserved about 4 miles of the trail as it winds around Upper Kinnick Arm and crosses these, you know, what's now Palmer Hayflat State Game Refuge and these other areas that are right along the coast. Those were really great travel corridors back then. It was colder, the ice was more consistent, and you could get across these large river complexes and move your way north, these really important corridors. So I think our work is, you know, land conservation for many different reasons, you know, historic and for habitat conservation, and it works really nicely that we also do conserve these historic corridors, which then often are really good corridors right now.
So, well, this doesn't necessarily mean purchase of land, right? It can be like an easement of some sort.
Exactly. So sometimes we're purchasing land, sometimes someone donates a conservation easement, sometimes we purchase just a conservation easement, which means that land is conserved forever, and we hold that easement, and we monitor it, and we partner with the Mat-Su Borough, with the municipality of Anchorage, with the Fish and Game, lots of different agencies and institutions.
So you hustle up the money to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the money comes from lots of different sources, private donations, hundreds and hundreds of individuals donate, corporations, foundations, and grant funds. And we also do fee-for-services work, so we get funding from lots of different sources. Any given project might involve, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different funding sources.
I said I wasn't going to bring it up, but I just have to mention, to see the look in your eyes when I do, RS-2477.
Right, yeah. So there are a number of federal and state components to access that are complex, that involve access and people's ability to get from place to place, and you know their choice of, you know, being able to institutionalize those access points. And so that's one of the components that anyone that does land conservation has to deal with, because it's a title issue and it affects.
Yeah, and so essentially what it says is that it's federal land that there could be, if there had been a traditional use of a corridor of some sort in the past, that could be then reestablished.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very touchy.
it is. It's touchy. And it's certainly important for people to get you know, these traditional routes sometimes are not well known and they're not well documented, and people know, okay, generally people went from this village to this village or around this direction, but we don't know exactly where those routes are. And so having, you know, these lands conserved allows that to, you know, those routes to be institutionalized and maintained.
I would think it would. Well, it's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about corridors, past and future, and our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. One of the things I really enjoy about Talk of Alaska is the fact that it is it's a statewide program. It has a geographic aspect to it. In other words, you bring up a subject, especially if it relates to a place, and it's quite likely that there are several listeners who personally have experience of that thing, and you're really encouraged to call if you hear anything familiar and you can add anything onto it. I want to turn back to a time. You know, we've already talked about trying to get a telegraph line in 1865, which totally blows my mind, and then getting one by 1903, I think, wasn't Wildcats 1904. Wildcats was pretty well all installed 1904. But I want to go back a few years before that to the journeys of exploration of Alaska that took place really before the Gold Rush, and turn to Walt Borman for some of those stories, which I think we can begin maybe with General Miles sitting down in Seattle and being the Army guy with Alaska under his jurisdiction.
Sure, Steve. As you mentioned before, it's really the Navy and, to some extent, the U.S. Treasury Department that are sort of administering Alaska. Army doesn't have really a formal role, but Nelson Miles is sitting in Seattle as commanding general of the Department of the Columbia, which includes Alaska, and he's saying, you know, gee, I'd really like to figure out a little bit more of what's going on up there, tie together the established Alaska Native corridor and trails that you folks are talking about, and really be able to tie together some of Alaska's geography and river systems. So it kind of starts in 1883 when he sends a Lieutenant Frederick Schwatka up to what today is basically Skagway. Of course, it wasn't there then. And Schwatka goes over the Chilkoot Pass into the headwaters of the Yukon. Doesn't really know it at that point, of course, but he's really on the corridor that's going to be the great route of the Gold Rush to Dawson about 15 years later. But he goes down the Yukon, and basically his contribution, I think, is that he's able to do the first complete descent of the Yukon and kind of put that river system onto the map of Alaska. Because as we all know, it's really pretty circuitous when you go from its headwaters there at Lake Bennett and down around through Dawson and, of course, all the way to St. Michael on the coast. So that's 1883, and that's Frederick Schwatka's.
Yeah, and then just to interrupt, so what we have so far is we have this general who's been, I think, goes all the way back to the Civil War, but also in the Indian Wars, right?
Correct.
General Miles, after whom a number of geographic features turn out to be named, as I'm sure we'll get to later on. But, you know, so this General Miles from the Indian Wars is kind of curious about the Indians that might live in this new part of the United States, this territory. And so he sends in a lieutenant who proceeds to go down the river and write a book about it, which was, you know, admired by the gold miners, I think, the Gold Rush people. They were influenced by Schwatka's book, right?
Well, they were, and I think that he's a promoter. I think that's why he may be known a little bit better than Henry T. Allen, who we're going to talk about in a moment, because he really did publicize, Schwatka did publicize his work, correct?
Yeah.
And there's a geography.
Oops.
But there's also an element, as you allude to, of, well, let's find out and interact a little bit with the Alaska Natives and see how their various territories are divided up, even though we recognize that there's some fluidity to those.
So it wasn't a genocidal kind of thing?
No, definitely not.
It was more a kind of thing of we need to know what we've got.
Yes.
Find you have different peoples, and they have different parts of the country that are theirs.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
And we need to know about that.
Right.
And the Navy will never find out.
Well, pretty much. The Army felt that Miles was kind of upset with Schwatka in publicizing some of this because the Navy, again, was administering Alaska, and I think Miles would have preferred that they just did this kind of on the QT.
Okay, so now there's another lieutenant.
There is.
Who gets sent up the copper, right?
Sent up the copper, and actually, we're going to talk about Allen, but there's a man named Abercrombie who goes up the copper the year after Schwatka. He's up the Copper River in 1884, and you mentioned that he names some features. I mean, that's the one thing that all of these European explorers seem that they have to do. They have to bestow European names, despite the fact that so many of these mountains and passes and rivers have had Alaska Natives. Names that go back generations and generations. But this Abercrombie goes up the Copper River and names the Miles Glacier and the Childs Glacier, which, of course, today are outside of Cordova at the site of what is going to be the Million Dollar Bridge on the Copper River and Northwestern.
Mm-hmm. Yep, so we got Miles Lake. We get all kinds of Miles things in the state.
Exactly, exactly.
So Henry T. Allen, Lieutenant Allen, then, goes up the river.
He does. And he's Miles's aide. And I think after the previous two expeditions, Miles still wants to know how the geography of some of these river basins in Alaska ties together. So he sends Allen up the Copper River, and Allen is basically at that point following in the footsteps of Abercrombie, and Allen gets up to the confluence of the Chitna and the Copper and faces a dilemma not unlike that faced by a number of explorers. He's not really sure which is the main stem. So he explores up the Chitna River, and we can talk about in a little bit some of his exploits there, but let me just give you the big picture of what he does. He explores up the Chitna and then comes back to the Copper, follows it up as the main stem, circling around the Wrangell Mountains, and then goes over passes that take him into the headwaters of the Tanana, and finally down the Tanana to the Yukon. Now, I don't know about you guys, but after I've done river trips like that or come out of the Wrangells, you know, I'm usually focused on a shower, beer, and a few other things. But after he's done this trip, he gets down on the Yukon, and he decides he's not done with his summer of exploration, and he goes up the Koyukuk River and engages in a number of other expeditions on some of its tributaries that we can talk about as well. But that's the big picture for Henry T. Allen. He really ties together those watersheds of the Copper, the Tanana, and the Koyukuk, and their relationship to the Yukon.
He draws the map, basically.
Well, he inks in those big spaces on the map.
Yeah,
I think that would be fair to say, right?
And it's remarkable because I guess he didn't have the literary gift that Schwatka did, and so people don't really remember Henry T. Allen, even though he almost became vice president.
Well, no less a person in Alaska history than Brooks basically says, look, this guy Allen was the Lewis and Clark of Alaska. He really tied a lot of this together. And you're right. Allen went back and reported to Miles, but he did not become the self-promoter that Schwatka did, and he basically continued. Allen continued his military career. He's a general in World War One, and then commands the occupation army in Germany. I mean, this is 1920 by this time, and he was talked about as a vice presidential candidate in 1928. And, wow. Like a number of people who've sort of crossed Alaska from time to time, and Morgan can talk about Billy Mitchell related to Wombcats, but Henry T. Allen, never went back to Alaska after all of this exploration that he'd done.
Yeah, okay, let's turn to Billy Mitchell and Wombcats. This would be a good point.
Yeah.
Morgan Blanchard.
Well, Billy Mitchell, as probably the best-known character of the Wombcats, sometimes he's erroneously described as the guy who built the Wombcats, but he was a very important guy because when they first started building the Wombcats, proved to be pretty difficult. The people that the Signal Corps was building it had just finished up operations in the Philippines during the war down there, the Spanish-American War. And so a bunch of these guys got sent up, and they were really puzzled about how to operate in Alaska. And in the first year, they built really small numbers of mileage. And so Billy Mitchell got sent up by Adolphus Greeley, who was the chief signal officer, to actually figure out, how are we going to build this thing? How are we going to speed it up? They were very worried that the funding would get canceled before they can complete it. So Mitchell went around and saw that trying to move around in the summertime was not very practical. You just couldn't get through the bogs and things that we are all very aware of across rivers.
Every Alaskan learns this.
Yeah. So he came up with this idea that let's move all the equipment in the wintertime. We'll take it out by mule or wagon or sled or dog sled, and cache it, and then cut the path, and then put it up in the summertime. The big thing that was causing a problem was everybody was really kind of worried about the cold. So one of the great stories about Mitchell is that he banned the private ownership of thermometers so that you could go out and work. And he figured, in his book, he says that working to minus 40 was pretty good, but every degree below that, it got really bad. But evidently that didn't do much, because the soldiers were pretty well aware of when certain objects froze. For example, rubber froze at minus 30 and kerosene froze solid at minus 50. So you didn't really need a thermometer. But Mitchell was quite a hard driver, and he was a fellow that mapped a number of the routes, particularly in the Eagle to Valdez section and the Good Pasture area. And he's also one of the best sources for information on the early Wompcats, because he did write a book about it. Mm. And he's got great stories about traveling, and anybody who's worked in the wintertime knows these kinds of things. But he tells a great story about moving through the Tokyo area and breaking through the ice in minus 60. And their kerosene was frozen solid. They broke two axe handles trying to start a fire. And the thing that I remembered as somebody from outside, I was amazed about this when I first came up here, they kept jumping back into the river because it was above 32 and it was minus 60. So it was 90 degrees warmer than what that was outside. So they would jump back in the water to warm up and then get back out. And fortunately, were able to start a fire and get their clothes off and dry out. So a remarkable, remarkable man. And of course, I think most people know him from being a giant advocate for air power and eventually being court-martialed for being a vocal advocate of air power. But he played an important role in the development of the Alaskan Wompcats.
Yeah. Well, wasn't he also involved in the Lend-Lease?
Yeah. Well, I thought he was. I'm not sure about that.
Hmm.
Yeah, but he was early advocate of bombers and air power.
So. Yeah, and then they end up there's quite the corridor right there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
A network. You were talking about wanting to put wires all the way over to Siberia, but they actually did that with airstrips, a network of airstrips that went all across the Arctic, all the way from Canada and on to the front of the war.
Absolutely. And just to touch back on something that Walt was saying, he was talking about Allen's activities and when they started actually constructing the Wompcats out of Valdez, the primary purpose was to go from Valdez to Eagle, which is close to the gold rush. They followed Allen's route. They built a road right along out of Valdez, up Keystone Canyon, out that way. And they called it the All-American Route. And it's something that we don't necessarily understand very well now, but there was a great deal of concern about have some sort of conflict with the Canadians, because the boundary wasn't really well drawn in the southeast. There had been sort of traditional difficulties with Canadians in the 19th century. And so in the military mind and in Congress, there was a real concern for this all-American route. And they didn't like the Skagway route because you had to go through Canada. And so they started to build a wagon road in 1898 and 99. Using soldiers and miners who had come up here and gone bust. And so the Army hired them to build this road so they could get a ticket and go home.
Yeah.
And so they built this this telegraph route along there. And if you ever have a choice, desire to see part of it, it actually, if you go to the NPS station for Wrangell St. Elias, at their headquarters, Copper Center, exactly right. There's a portion of that trail that they have done some archaeology on and is open to walk on, right. And so you can actually see part of that.
Yeah, Walt Borman, you go up there to the Wrangells, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I've flown out of McCarthy and done some good backpacks and everything, and that's why I'm familiar with having a shower and a beer when I get out.
Yeah, and it must kind of give you a thrill knowing the history, knowing that this might be where Allen went here and all that.
Well, absolutely, and then the railroads that follow. And then, of course, on Morgan's point, I was thinking, describing this all-American route, that was actually even from the Klondike. There was this mentality that instead of going over White Pass or Chilkoot Pass to get to the Klondike, we want an all-American route to go through there and be able to access not only the Klondike gold fields but interior Alaska. And that mentality of an all-American route, I mean, that continues through history. It continues into the 60s and 70s when we're talking about a pipeline route and whether it should go through Canada or whether it should come basically down the Copper River route or close to it, at least to Valdez. So it's kind of interesting how these themes continue to replay themselves over history.
It is indeed, and I guess what I'm, if there's any bottom line on this show at all, outside of just learning a bunch of really fascinating history, it is that that anytime you have a corridor, it's in the midst of change. It starts in change, and change continues. And we see that with the Iditarod. It's very sobering right now to think that we will have a ceremonial start this year in Anchorage, but how many years really will the Iditarod be able to do the Rainy Pass route in the future? We don't really know. I mean, the nature of our corridors never stops changing. And I think we might get to talking about Wamcats and its relationship to the telecommunications situation in Alaska at the present day, which is, kind of based on Wamcats. And then you can go on and think about, well, what are the implications really going to be if they get this? This summer, they're supposed to lay a cable across the Arctic, under the Arctic Ocean, and all of a sudden, Barrow and communities along the Bering Sea coast are going to be tied into fiber optic cable. I mean, world-class fiber optic communications, broadband. It's a lot to think about as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying dealers throughout Alaska with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser water heaters for more than 28 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. The American Lung Association of Alaska invites you to join their premier annual cycling event, the Clean Air Challenge, on May 9th. This family-friendly one-day event begins in Talkeetna and offers routes ranging from 10 to 100 miles. This fundraiser benefits the American Lung Association to support lung health programs across Alaska. For more information, visit cleanairchallengeak.org.
Boy, it's like a meeting of the Alaska History Club. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. That's statewide. If you're calling from Anchorage, you just use the local number, 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. With me, I have Phil Shepard, Executive Director of the Great Land Trust, which is kind of helping to keep our trails, I guess you would say. By telephone from Colorado, I've got Walt Bornman, author of Alaska, Saga of a Bold Land, and Morgan Blanchard, an archaeologist with Northern Land Use Research Alaska, who wrote his doctoral dissertation on the subject of the Wamcats military communications system that was installed in Alaska at the turn of the last century. And it's fascinating how all these things interweave. So there's so many different ways to go, but I think where I want to go that I think will really interest our listeners, Walt Bornman, is where Chief Nikolai shows up in this saga of Henry Miles.
Well, Henry Allen. Henry Allen is.
I'm sorry, Henry Allen.
He's going to go. Too many names to keep straight. Henry Allen's decided he's going to get an early start. It's the spring of 1885, and he figures that the best way to get up the lower Copper is to go as early as possible when it's still iced over, and he's got a chance of moving up it. And he gets up as far as Terrell, which is just below Chitna in the confluence of the Copper. And the Chitna, and he's going up the Chitna, and basically he's basically almost starving. He's already begun to run out of supplies. He's lost some supplies. And one thing we didn't point out before, it's kind of interesting. You know, there have been big expeditions, and then there have been small, almost like you think current-day alpine mountaineering expeditions. And Allen is only out there at this point with really two other guys. There's a couple of prospectors that kind of float in and out of his party, but he really only has a sergeant. He's a lieutenant. He's got a sergeant and a private with him. Well, to your question, they get up the Chitna ways, and then they're looking for routes, and they portage over into the drainage of the where the Chittistone comes down, and they come upon an Otna camp and Chief Nikolai, and basically they've been reduced to eating moose meat that is saturated with maggots. It's Allen's 26th birthday, and basically, to be blunt, Chief Nikolai probably saves their lives, both in terms of providing them with food, but also giving them a clue as to where they are, and he basically takes them after a few days, back down the Chitna and points him in the direction of the Copper, takes him up the Copper a ways until where the Otna lands sort of give way to the Tanana lands, and the Copper bends back onto the north side of the Wrangell. So Chief Nikolai, who's going to come up again in Alaska history in terms of, in a few years, the Copper gold rush to Kennecott and all of that, really is instrumental in not only saving Henry Allen's life, but also pointing out these historic Alaska Native trails and corridors and kind of getting him on his way.
And then saying, I can't go any further than this. It's somebody else's country after this.
Yeah, exactly. Chief Nikolai says that, but Allen, of course, goes on and crosses over again, just like Phil was talking about historic corridors and following through. In a very broad general sense, his route between the Copper and the Upper Tanana is sort of beyond Glen Allen, the continuation of the Glen Highway, and going on over the Toke Cutoff there is where he's headed.
Yeah. You know, there's it brings this notion of these territories and corridors brings to mind folklore and tales I've heard that are historic tales. Henry Huntington has got one in his book about the divide between the people of the interior and the people of the coast, and someplace up there in some pass. It's a very important little spot of geography that you have to cross. And it's very interesting, very pervasive in Alaska, especially in the north, tales involving that piece of ground. You know, and we have an archaeologist with us, Morgan Blanchard. You probably get to go to some of these remote places.
Yeah, that's one of the great parts of this job. We're working on projects throughout the state, and so we get to go to communities and even very remote areas. Spent time south side of the Brooks Range, in the middle of No Place, Seward Peninsula, different spots. And it's great fun because coming from working on the Wamcats, obviously, it's a huge system. It's 1,400, 1,500 miles long, changing throughout its entire operation. Many of these communities were served either by telegraph stations or later radio stations. And so one of the great fun side jobs as I go through the remote parts of Alaska is to find those parts of the Wamcat system and look for those traces of it. And, yeah, you get to see some remarkable places.
Let's go to Mary, joins the program from Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mary.
Thank you, Steve Heimel. This is Mary Sattler calling.
Hey, Mary.
Hi. This is a fascinating show, and I just wanted to let your listeners know that in the Yukon-Kuskokwim region, we're also looking at a corridor that reconnects the Yukon and the Kuskokwim rivers. There's a pinch point that's relatively close, and we feel that it'd be beneficial for our region to have you know, eventually possibly petroleum products shipped down on the Yukon so that the Kuskokwim folks can have access to those and people along those two huge river stems. But the real reason I'm calling, Steve, is because I just want to thank you for all your years of service. And I've always found you to be a free thinker and really a deep thinker, and you've really helped us have respectful discourse on a lot of these open-ended questions that Alaska faces.
Oh, that's so nice of you, Mary. I remember when you were a guest on this show as a promising Native youth. You remember that?
No, I don't, but that's okay.
You were on the show. I remember that very well. It was I'm trying to remember, I think it was Stephen Blanchett was on there with you. And
that's probably about in 1995 or 1900, yep. The 1900s, as we say. So anyway, best of luck in all your future endeavors.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, people that want to call up just to give me good wishes, that's fine, but you might want to save them for next week, because there'll be plenty of them next week. Let's go to Kotzebue now, and Bob. Bob, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, good morning.
How are you?
Oh, I am just excellent. We're getting some beautiful straight down snow in Kotzebue.
Great. Did you get that storm there, that wind?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I thought so.
It was a five-day blizzard. Well, it was two cells. And it gave us the best, you know, the most snow we've had this year.
That's kind of the
thing that I wanted to talk about. You mentioned, about Rainy Pass and the Farewell Burn and, you know, the problems with the Iditarod Trail. And our severe winters, high snow winters up here, are always when there is a La Nina current in the Pacific Ocean. And when there's an El Nino current, we have great winters up here. It draws the jet stream south. And I'm a ham radio operator, and I talk to guys in the lower 48 and on almost a daily basis. And the northern tier, for the whole month of January, except for two or three days of the lower 48, was colder than we were here in Kotzebue, 30 miles north of the Arctic Circle.
Exactly, north of the Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they're colder than us by many times, 30 or 40 degrees colder. I mean, I remember talking to Kentucky when it was minus 17, and we're sitting here at 36.
Well, hey, Bob, being as how you're a ham radio operator, it's getting a little quiet out there on the shortwave, isn't it?
Actually, there's lots of new developments on that.
Really?
And one of the things that I use is a voice over IP protocol called IRLP.
Mm-hmm.
And you use a radio, hook it to a computer, and the computer digitizes it and sends it over the internet.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, there you are. You don't even use the radio anymore, see? And then, Ecuador went off the air. they're going down like crazy. They're dropping like dominoes. All those great old shortwave outlets aren't happening anymore.
Oh, yeah, a lot of them are going by the wayside. But getting back to the pattern of the warm winters and low snow winters, remember the year in Valdez when they had 60 some feet of snow?
Oh my God!
A La Nina winter.
Yeah.
And so I think it'll come back. It cycles. You know, we're not on a straight line curve, or a straight line progression.
Yeah.
And up here we have Cape Krusenstern, and archaeologists have gone out there, and there's beach ridges that are probably 100 feet apart on the peaks, And there's like in one place you can count like 40 beach ridges from the where the beaches used to be. And each one of those ridges is built up by a storm cycle, and they're about 500 years apart, and they're quite regular.
Yeah. Very good,
so,
Bob.
You know. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, that's it. I want to thank you because I think you're right that there will be cycles, but we could really get a number of years in which there's the type of blocking that creates a. Bad conditions on the southern part of the Iditarod Trail.
Oh yeah, yeah. And right now, last year was a pretty warm winter here and a mild winter here in Kotzebue, and you know so is this winter. And I think this is probably the peak of it, and it's going to start you know going back to regular weather patterns again.
I hope so. Bob, I want to thank you for your call.
Oh, you betcha. Thanks a lot. Thanks. Great show.
All right. Yeah, it's great to hear from Kotzebue. I think we'll take our break right now as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
It's Talk of Alaska. We have Walt Borman, author of Alaska, Saga of a Bold Land, Phil Shepard of the Great Land Trust, Morgan Blanchard, an archaeologist with Northern Land Use Research Alaska, and from Scott and Fairbanks comes a question one of you is going to have the answer to. There was a route between Fairbanks and Nome across the Brooks Range that mail carriers used to use. Does anyone on the show know what that route was called?
I don't. I don't know that. I know that their mail was frequently run along the Wamcats routes, but I don't know one that went north of the Brooks Range.
Walt Borman, you got any idea?
I think between Fairbanks and Nome, east-west, I'm not aware of anything that went north across the Brooks Range. No, I'm not.
Okay, well, that's the best we can do there for Scott. Let's go to Dennis, joins the program from Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dennis.
Hello. Yeah, my dad was one of those guys that was worked for ACS, which was the successor to Wamcats. He came to Alaska in the Signal Corps during World War II and then ended up working as a civilian employee after the war until it was sold to RCA and became Alascom. But, you know, there was a whole corridor, speaking of corridors, communication corridor, that's still in use going from Port Angeles, Washington, to Ketchikan, to Petersburg, to Lena Point, and then on to Skagway, and then up the White Pass Railroad route to Whitehorse, up the Alaska Highway as far as Tok, and then down to Richardson, which provided military communications, and as an accessory use, provided civilian communications. So if you wanted to make a long-distance phone call or send a telegram, you had to go to the U.S. Army or eventually the Air Force to do it. And that's a little-known part of Alaska history, but at one point the agency had stations, communication stations all over Alaska, and that was who you used for your long-distance telephone and your telegrams. It was a very interesting part of Alaska history that I hope somebody documents before those old brass pounders pass away. They also ran the marine operator system to take messages from marine radio users and pass them on to, or hook them up to telephone calls or pass them on as telegrams. And some of those old guys could really multitask. I remember watching one gentleman talking to somebody in his office while he listened with a headphone on one ear and sent and received telegrams from two separate people with two hands.
Wow. What did you call it, brass pounders?
Yeah, the guys that set Morse code.
Yeah, right. Wow. Yeah, well, there probably are not all that many of them anymore.
Well, actually, I let you know that there is an active ACS Wildcats Veterans Group that publishes a newsletter every year. They're out of Seattle, and I'm very fortunate that they've kind of made me an honorary member since I did some research with them. But they have some fascinating stories that they have told and are very active about trying to get that history down.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm sorry I've never been able to make it to their picnic in Seattle that they have every year. As a matter of fact, I still have my dad's old Army telegraph key.
Great, Dennis. Hey, thanks for that. That was a great call.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Dennis. Let's go now to Palmer. And Mark joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mark.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Steve. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to give a shout out to Great Land Trust and the work they're doing out in the Mat-Su, because as much as I think it's important to understand the historical significance of corridors, I think it's equally and more important to look forward and take those hard steps to protect or even recreate the corridors that are important, because especially in our urbanizing areas, it's difficult work. So I just wanted to kind of thank them for the work, and I'll hang up and take any comments off the air. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for that, Mark. And yeah, I want to sort of underscore that. I think one of the reasons Mat-Su is so critical is that it's the fastest growing part of the state population-wise. So these conservation decisions are thundering down upon us.
Yeah, Mat-Su just recently did a build-out scenario, and the population of Mat-Su Borough is on a trajectory that within the next 60 to 100 years will be at 300,000, and it will, you know, be a very different place. And so the citizens and, you know, the individuals that live there and us as community organizations need to figure out, well, what do we want the Mat-Su to look like? And in conjunction with UAA's Institute of Social and Economic Research, we've recently done some work to figure out, well, what are people most interested in? And you know, people are really concerned about things like salmon, access to recreation, and farmland. And one of the things that they did was they did it's called a willingness to pay study. So this was just a random survey, send out a bunch of queries to individuals that live in the Mat-Su. And are people willing to actually pay for things like restoration of salmon runs or setting aside farmland or access to trails? And people are. People are willing to pay, you know, several hundred dollars a year as an individual to be able to know that there, you know, there'll still be salmon in the streams, wow, there'll still be these trails.
And that's hard dollars.
It is hard dollars. And, you know, so basically they're saying they're willing to tax themselves, which is a really big deal, that those are such important values that, and this is a random survey, this is not just, you know, a few choice individuals. This went out to thousands of folks. So that was significant, you know, that people really do, you know, the reason people live here is we've got this fabulous resource.
I'll tell you one that really stuck out for me is the fact that the difference of view makes to property values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People, I mean, look at 20%.
Yeah. People will pay substantially more to live on a salmon stream or on a lake that has a nice view. And, you know, everyone knows that. It's all about location. Right. And so our salmon streams provide real economic value just from the standpoint of property values.
Yeah. It's hard to quantify sometimes, but mm-hmm. that's the nice thing about the study here.
So thanks for the acknowledgement. It is challenging work. It's definitely a collaborative effort with lots and lots of different partners, and it results in these projects that are permanent. They're, you know, these land conservation projects that last for generations. And so we at Great Land Trust are very appreciative of our partners.
Marcia joins the program from Petersburg. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Marcia.
Well, hi, Steve, and thank you very much for this show and all your shows. What I wanted to bring up was the importance of the marine corridor along the BC coast down to Seattle historically and currently.
Yep.
And, you know, I think one thing that needs to be remembered, it wasn't too many years ago that our commercial fishermen were having a problem traveling along that BC coast when all of a sudden Canada said they didn't want us stopping in for gas or anything else.
I almost forgot that.
Yeah, it wasn't that many years ago, you know, I don't know, less than 10 or less than 15, certainly.
Yeah, yeah, very good point. Love it.
Well, just one other thing I wanted to say. On behalf of all of us here in Petersburg, and there's been many of us speaking about this, we know your time is coming to an end way too soon, and we appreciate all the shows you've done, and especially the holiday greeting show is just not going to be the same without your personal touch.
I'm gonna batter down the doors if they don't let me do that one.
Well, good. And oh, and the other thing, now don't forget, you've got a invitation, standing invitation, to come to the Little Norway Festival. It's usually about the 17th of May, and as Sally Dwyer from the Sons of Norway Hall told you during the holiday
show,
you know, 4 days of partying, so
all right.
Come on down.
All right, well, you know, I'd like to be able to come on the radio also and do the local, the Bush messages. They probably got that.
Oh, yeah.
On KFSK. I'd love to host one of those.
Well, you know, I'm sure you're welcome anytime you show up in town.
That's great.
just come. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Steve.
All right, thanks. So here's a question for you, Walt Bornman from Judy. She says, is the actual site of Chief Nikolai's camp at the base of the Chitty Stone ever been identified? Is there an actual location on Dan Creek that's been identified? And actually, Morgan Blanchard may know, too.
I'll pass to Morgan because I'm not sure, you know, the general location's known, but I'm not sure if the exact location has ever been figured out. Morgan?
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I haven't worked specifically on that particular project. So I'm not sure it's been cited either.
Well, it could be an expedition to find it. They're probably.
Yeah, I'd be willing to go. That sounds good.
All right. In Anchorage, Doug, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good morning there, Steve. Enjoying the show. Hey, one historical corridor area during the Gold Rush that you don't hear too much about is the Upper Kuskokwim. And I was digging into information trying to find out the occurrence of salmon in some of the tributaries up there to Kootenai specifically. And I was just fascinated to hear about the paddle wheel boats that all used to go up there and I guess run out of time, but I was wondering if your guests would be interested in touching on that at all.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, certainly, paddle wheel boats, stern wheeler boats, played an important role in bringing supplies into the interior of Alaska.
You betcha.
You know, the old saying was that if you had money, you came by water.
Yeah.
You didn't make that long trek overland. So a lot of people did come in. The Wamcats did play a role in that. Once they moved to radios, they would monitor the traffic going up and down and coordinate deliveries. It was a huge thing for the local economies, too. Many native peoples and just miners, folks working in the interior, would cut wood and sell it to the steamers. It was a way to bring things in and out.
I want to thank everybody for being on the show. Walt Bornman, thank you.
Good to be with you. Thanks, guys.
Phil Shepard, Morgan Blanchard, thank both of you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much.
Thanks to Josh Edge, Dave Waldron. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.